And welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime. Now, normally at this time, we would have been live, but because we've just come back from our pledge drive, and thank you so much for your pledge of support to the radio station, we've decided to take a little bit of a break of sorts in terms of going live. We'll do that next month, but this month, it's my pleasure to sit and talk with the tummy doc. Dr. Richard McCallum is here from Texas Tech, the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine. You know him very well, the founding chair, professor of medicine, Department of Internal Medicine, the founding chair. And with us, brand new guest and hopefully a co-host as well, Sandra Vexler. She's a child and adolescent fellow of psychiatry also at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. Welcome to Primetime, the both of you.
Thanks very much. Good afternoon, audience. Good to be back, Dennis. Good to be back with you.
Good to be back with the two of you, especially Sandra. We met at NAMI Walk a couple of weeks ago, and we got to talking about issues that really do impact all of our audiences. And it tied in quite well, Doc, with your vast studies in gastroenterology and all that. So my sense is, let's just go ahead and open up the field and let's talk a little bit about your studies.
Good idea, Dennis.
Dr. Vexler, first, let's start with you. Dealing with adolescence, one of the things that strikes me that I thought about all day long, actually, was the tie-in between Dr. Richard McCallum's studies in gastroenterology and your studies in that field of adolescent, oh my gosh, where am I going? All of my hormones are raging, and one thing leads to another. Anorexia nervosa comes into play, bulimia comes into play, all of these little eating disorders that lead to massive GI tract problems later on, and even at that age. Where does it start? How does it start? How do parents cope with it?
So we often find eating disorders can start with something as little as a comment at school by a bully telling you that you're fat. You know, we know very well that the media and images portrayed in the media about being thin and being perfect and being beautiful may also influence adolescents, boys and girls alike. Can be such a devastating illness. You know, one of the hardest illnesses to treat and for kids and adolescents to get over, and sometimes one of the hardest for parents to understand. So it a lot of times is something that spirals from a child or adolescent feeling like they don't have any control over their life and feeling like this is the only way that I can really get some sense of control. If I can control what I eat, maybe I can control other things in my life. My grades are slipping, or I feel like I have no friends at school. Mom and dad don't understand me. And so they start by maybe restricting some of their eating or, you know, eating too much and then feeling overwhelmed by the amount of food that they eat and then starting to purge, throw up, you know, exercise too heavily.
So, Doc, when a student comes in or a parent, and they're often very perplexed why it starts. And Dr. Vexler spells out the emotional end, the little triggers that start that process. But, Doc, you've seen what happens with bulimia and anorexia and all of the other eating disorders. How do you treat something like that from the early stages? Or do you even get as far as getting the latter stages where they're just extremely, extremely over the top?
Yeah, Dennis, thanks. Well, Dr. Vexler did a very nice job, I think, in painting some of the sort of seeds of adolescence. I often obviously don't get an opportunity to interact at that level. I'm more in the, could be late teenage adult year, early adult years, but often even into the adult years, we see some of the ravages, if you like, of anorexia. Sometimes the patients come to me in the setting of I've got unexplained vomiting, and after a while we understand that this vomiting is a unique type of vomiting that occurs usually within minutes of eating. They can regurgitate food they've eaten. freshly eaten in the last 15 to 20 minutes. It comes up as like a fountain into their mouth, an effortless fountain called rumination. And we begin to meet them and try to help them to reject that and overcome it, breathing, meditation, distraction, other techniques. But then as we get to know the patient, unfortunately, we learn that a subset have a goal not to gain weight, not to want to eat, and to, in a way, to be refractory or very difficult to manage because of the fear of actually gaining weight. We're trying to return them to so-called normalcy, which means at least maintaining weight or getting back to their old weight. They're in the business of trying not to do that. So I often unmask what I call closet anorexics. These could be some of your friends at cocktail parties who actually are closet anorexics. They may look a little thin. They may look like they're on the red carpet at Hollywood some night, but they're actually, it's not just working out and eating kale. It's actually anorexic behavior, which we then finally unravel, sort of like a closet alcoholic. There's closet anorexics out there who come to me in the name of unexplained weight loss and vomiting. So we're often forced to actually do some fairly extreme things. We've got to put tubes in their intestines sometimes because they've lost so much weight. And what's one of the most dangerous things about anorexics is when they regurgitate and vomit, they vomit fluid back from their stomach, including potassium. And they develop very low potassiums, and you can die of cardiac arrhythmias. That's how our well-known entertainer, Karen Carpenter, the Carpenter twins, brother and sister, rather, Karen Carpenter died of anorexia nervosa, and she died of a cardiac arrhythmia due to profound hypokalemia. So this can become interesting as a teenager to actually life-threatening and overwhelming and a long-term career as an adult. And this is can be reversible. I'm not the end product. I'm a sort of a facilitator of nutrition. We have to work with our psychologist team to try to sustain and maintain the other part of their life. But I often see that segment or that portion of their career.
So that leads me to another piece of this puzzle that I hadn't quite frankly thought about it until after we met at NAMI Walks. One of the things that has always intrigued me working with Dr. McCallum over the years is that the gut, the GI tract, really does have more of a say of what goes inside the brain than we really give it credit. The studies are beginning to show that quite well as well. There's this one topic, as I think about it, Dr. Vexer, the piece that you brought to the table about the microbiome, the gut microbiome, the remodeling. There's this – it's an enormous title to something very simply put that the microbiome can create a depressive-like state. So one leads to another, and the study began with mice, you know, checking out what they do. And now when you translate it over to humans, now it starts to make a whole lot of sense why we have so many people who have seemingly unexplained depressive states, when if they really dug down deep, it would be all about the GI tract.
Well, you know, it's excellent. We'll add some more, I'm sure. What we're finding is that these billions of bugs in our colon, which are living in, it's sort of an unusual situation. It's sort of schizophrenic. You've got billions of bugs in 6 feet of colon, ending with your rectum and sort of sealed off by what's called the ileocecal valve. It's not airtight, but it's a gate. And we're living with very, very dangerous characters. If let out into a certain situation, they could actually cause havoc health-wise. These are very dangerous bugs, but we've got them in jail, living in our colon, taking care of some daily issues and sort of maintaining symbiosis. The question is, in a way, could some of us really be a representation of our microbiota? There's work now saying that if you got your stool out and profiled your stool, that's better than a thumbprint or a retinal picture. That is you. Your stool is you. Those billions of microbiota are uniquely you. And they've done some work in anorexic mice, taking obese mice's stool and putting them into the colon and taking anorexic mice stool and putting them into obese mice. And indeed, by restoring the microbiota in each of those different settings, you can take away the anorexia and the obesity to some degree. So then the question comes, can we alter our own microbiota and perhaps take away personality, aspects of our life, stress-prone individuals, depression that are not responding to maybe the simple antidepressants? Could we be dealing with an intrinsic environment here which is feeding us? There's some new work actually at UCLA in the GI world, simple work, where they said, let's take probiotics, which theoretically change your microbiota, and take MRI images. These are in irritable bowel syndrome patients. And take MRI images before and after, you know, 6 or 12 weeks of probiotics. And indeed, they could find subtle changes, namely, in the GI world, we would stress the patient through a stressful interview, or and sometimes we blow a little balloon up in the rectum and cause pain in the gut. Irritable bowel patients are extremely prone to what's called visceral sensitivity. They're very sensitive to pain. After 6 weeks or 3 months of probiotics, their response on the MRI, the number of areas that were sort of sensitized or prone to the pain message, changed. So indeed, right now in the NIH world and in the grant world, if you're going to write a grant, you write a grant on microbiota. It's one of those things we can't get enough of. It'll burn out eventually. There will be limits. It's not going to explain everything. But right now, it's open for discussion as to how much we can go. How far can we go with blaming the microbiota? Be interested in Dr. Wechsler's take on some of the work that's being done in her area.
So I think that some of the studies they're coming back, you know, as with everything in research, some are saying that, yes, there's a definite link between taking probiotics, changing the bacteria in your GI system and doing away with some depression and anxiety symptoms, and then other studies that show that maybe there's no difference mm-hmm. with probiotics. Of course, there's so many probiotics out there on the market, right?
Yeah. So that's one of the problems. I mean, you could get even more radical. You know, as we do in certain diseases in GI, what's called Clostridium difficile. This is a problem that occurs if you take antibiotics and you get overridden by Clostridium difficile, severe diarrhea, and you don't respond. The treatment now is to do a fecal transplant. I take the feces from your mother, your brother, your cousin, or a friend. We emulsify them, and we can reinsert them through a colonoscope, or they've made them into tablets now. And so we can do a transplant of your colon. And those patients get better from their C. diff, and they respond. They've got a new microbiota being restored. So an extreme form would be to, you know, do a transplant maybe in some of these very depressed patients and see if we were to rehabilitate your colonic flora, correlate with any improvement in your personality or something. That would be a rather radical step versus massaging it with, vegetarian food chains or probiotics or restoring a new or healthier lifestyle. You know, all the things that might perturbate and change your intrinsic microbiota. So this is a very good area, I think, to work within the body. Could we change ourselves rather than take all those powerful drugs and get shock therapy and all things that might happen? Could we do something more sort of natural to augment our own defenses? So I think this is a very timely discovery, the microbiota, as far as trying to it sort of ties in with health in general. And focuses on your own body and what you're eating and what you're subjecting it to. So I think it meets a lot of needs, which may play into health and CNS, depression, other things may all play in together. It's by being a more responsible person who thinks about their health and their body.
I think there are some really interesting studies, like Dr. McCallum was talking about, with regards to mice. And so one of the really interesting studies I read about with regards to obesity.
Yeah.
So let me explain this in layman's terms. You have two groups of mice, a mouse that eats, let's say, Subway every day, and then a mouse that eats McDonald's, right? So clearly the Subway mouse is going to be healthier, thinner, fitter. The McDonald's mouse is heavier, has more inflammation going on. And so they did this fecal transplant where they exchanged the bacteria that were in the two mice with each other, the two groups of mice. And the Subway mice continued to eat Subway, but now they had the McDonald's mice bacteria in their system, and they gained weight over time. And the McDonald's mice continued to eat McDonald's, but now that they had the Subway bacteria in their tummy, they were getting thinner. Over time, of course, everyone returned back to their normal heavy and light weight, respectively. But similarly, they've been doing some studies with mice about depression. And so they found a way to make mice depressed. Don't ask me how. I don't know how to ask a mouse how they're feeling today. We haven't gotten to that level of training yet. But they were able to change some of the bacteria in the mice in their GI tract and find that the mice exhibited fewer symptoms of depression. And so that's some of the research they're trying to translate now into human.
So my curiosity is now piqued because of 20th century, quote unquote, advances in fast food leading to the 21st century. In both worlds, in gastroenterology and also in psychiatry, the history of how we now perceive our diets, does it show that possibly back in the 19th century, early 20th century, where we didn't have fast food, the prevalence of depression was diminished somewhat through the diets back in the day?
You know, I've heard some claims, Dr. McCallum. Mm. I don't know if you can speak to this. I don't know what the research behind it shows, but there are a lot of trends now with the paleo diet and eating like a caveman, you know, a lot of meats and nuts and fruits and vegetables, no refined sugars. And I believe that the author of the paleo diet does actually report that mood changes, improved mood, less depression, less anxiety are part of the benefits of following sort of this archaic caveman type diet.
One of the other things is the gut itself, Dennis. So, you know, the caveman had a lot of acid in his stomach. He was not being inhibited by what half of the world now takes, called proton pump inhibitors and acid blocking drugs for heartburn, belching, tummy aches, and any other miscellaneous disturbance that you call your GP about. He was working with a full deck of cards, and he was stamping out anything that got into grubs and bugs and things he ate. Your acid took care of it. And acid, in turn, creates a hostile environment in your gut down to your distal intestine, where it joins up with these billions of bugs. And it says to the bugs, don't come up here north of the colon. It's very hostile, and we've got control of this country. We're now taking PPIs and acid medications everywhere. And some of us may be born with low acid. We don't know who they are, but all of us have a spectrum of acid production, from very high acid secretion to very low. High may be the more ulcer-prone patient. Low, we're not really defending well. So there are a subset of patients now who are exposed to proton pump inhibitors and acid blockers, and or could be born with low acid, who are definitely more likely to have bugs coming up into their intestine, occupying parts of the gut which were not involved before. This is the people with gas and bloating, because you're breaking down your food, particularly your glucose and your fructose, parts of your sweeteners, parts of your food, making boatloads of gas and bloating, and fermenting different short-chain fatty acids and things in our gut. So we're also a victim of modern-era pharmacology, much of which we're taking. Sometimes for good reason, sometimes by being overtreated. And we could argue that we have manipulated our microbiota that way. We're taking antibiotics frequently. That takes a hit. We've got to nurture and replenish the environment of our microbiota after we get 2 weeks of antibiotic X or Y. So a lot of things have happened since the caveman. And so today we're sort of a mixed bag of lots of things ravaging our microbiota. It's trying to come back and return to its so-called original state. And whether some of the entities that we're seeing in the psychological world and maybe the obesity anorexia world, could they be something that where the seeds are being planted in these manipulations and perturbations of our microbiota? So these are other fascinating things that go on in my patients. They're all taking something which could change their flora.
To include some diabetes medications like metformin, which can decrease the amount of acid your stomach makes, and some of my psychiatric medications, antidepressants, some of the antipsychotics and mood stabilizers for people who have bipolar disorders, things like lithium and some of those medications. And to the point where because the acid content is lower in the stomach, which we know where a lot of vitamin absorption may occur, there's some new evidence about vitamin B12 deficiency and changing the amount of supplementation and being more proactive and more aggressive about supplementing various different vitamins and minerals, but for the purpose of this conversation, B12. And, you know, having a little bit of a lower B12 can lead to also symptoms of depression, anxiety, even psychosis, which means hallucinations, hearing things, seeing things, you know, having disorganized thinking, poor cognitive abilities and nerve problems. So you have, you know, maybe a diabetic person who's taking metformin and other drugs trying to control their diabetes, and they become deficient in some of these vitamins, and, you know, they feel like they have neuropathy, the pins and needles feeling in their fingers and toes, and they're taking more medication on top of that for that. And, it, you know, it might be that there's some more nutrition and supplementation that can help really bring some of that back.
Well, that brings me to another question about vitamin deficiency, and that would be vitamin D. It seems like in the past we spent more time outdoors doing things, whether it was gardening, whether it was walking, waiting for the bus, doing this, doing that. But as time progressed, we're in the car, then we're in a building, then we get back into the car, then we go home. And so there's never really enough time to absorb whatever we get from sunlight in order to metabolize into vitamin D. So how do people figure out how to get that back into the system, which probably will lead to some kind of an anxiety because of the lack of vitamin D? Lack of vitamin D also, I assume, affects the GI tract in some adverse way. How do we get people back outdoors again?
Let me add, vitamin D deficiency in kids also adds to irritability and hyperactivity. So your ADHD kids, too, can have worse symptoms.
That's really an important point, especially for our parents listening today, because we opened up with the curiosity about the beginnings of anorexia and bulimia and eating disorders. But that absence of vitamin D also affects ADHD. And I hadn't thought about that till now. So bring this all back into the conversation at the table.
Well, my patients, obviously, I see a lot of patients who have nausea and vomiting, degrees of diarrhea, and probably malnutrition. So, you know, it's not hard to imagine that even before the sunlight in the outdoors world, we're fighting, are we getting enough vitamin D and calcium alone to even sustain and maintain nutrition? But assuming we do, we again worry about the gut and the flora. So if you're taking, again, these antacid-type acid-blocking drugs and creating a relatively hypochlorhydric or low-acid environment in your gut, bacteria flourish, and they tend to interfere with fat-soluble vitamins, A, D, E, and K, fat-soluble vitamins. And so there's a study in nursing homes where the women who got broken hips in the nursing homes versus the women who were just in the nursing homes, the ones with the broken hips when they fell had a history of taking these acid-blocking drugs for some years versus the women of the same age who fell but didn't get a broken hip. They didn't have osteoporosis. They didn't have weak bones. They didn't have poor calcium content in the bone. So the theory was maybe, again, changing acid environments in our gut and causing microbe flora so-called bacterial overgrowth in our gut to break down and interfere with the absorption of calcium is playing a role in long-term nutrition above and beyond sunlight. Because you said in El Paso, it's hard to believe you couldn't get enough sunlight for whatever reason. So we're concerned about intake. We do recommend supplements. People do get bone scans, particularly women, around menopausal era of their life. We recommend bone scanning to look for osteopenia before it gets to osteoporosis, which is the more florid form. But I think we probably have to recommend and keep on the burner, just like we get breast exams and pap smears and colonoscopies. We probably need to get a bone scan at some point in our 40s, early 50s, to see whether we're one of those groups that evidently don't absorb enough calcium.
Right, and we know that hormones can suck calcium up, so birth control, you know, postmenopausal women who are taking estrogen supplements, all those things can definitely affect that. And don't forget, too, that vitamin D is harder to absorb in sunlight if you have darker skin, so that might be a contributor. I've heard pediatricians here in town say that for some reason, El Paso kids really seem to be vitamin D deficient. And we know that milk is supplemented with vitamin D now, and they are outside. You know, with the advent of Pokemon Go, I know kids are spending a whole lot of time outside now, but it's definitely something to keep in mind.
Let me extend an invitation for our listeners to take two. Let me extend an invitation to our listeners to check out our live version of this next month. I'd like to invite the two of you back in so we can talk to our listeners about issues that affect adolescents, both in the GI tract and in an emotional state. There's a more than enough bullying, sadly enough, that still goes on. And there are strategies in order to be able to stem that tide in one form or another. So I'd love to have you back.
Dennis, thanks very much. Let me put a little plug in for the free clinic.
Absolutely.
Down there at Zaragoza. I was down there this morning and on Shrop. Our medical students, first and second years, are down there working hard. Please, if you need help and you're underserved and have no insurance, you can go to the Rota Care Texas Tech Free Clinic or the Baptist Clinic. Other clinics are there. And Dennis, for you and I, old 60s guys, don't forget Bob Dylan's going to be in El Paso on the 19th of October. You can get religion. Thanks very much, everyone. Good afternoon.